TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Picks and Shovels by Cory Doctorow with Yanis Varoufakis. On the most powerful tool for crime ever invented, the personal computer. David Moskrop invited Cory Doctorow and Yanis Varoufakis to a conversation. They met on February 15, 2025. They discuss how the concentration of wealth and power and surveillance is made possible by the internet, where someone like Elon Musk uses digital power to determine the outcome of an election and then proceeds to dismantle democratic institutions. Here are excerpts from a one-hour meeting published on the Jacobin YouTube channel. David Moskrop introduces Cory Doctorow and his conversation partner Yanis Varoufakis. His most recent book is Techno-Feudalism, What Killed Capitalism? Varoufakis is describing that we are not transitioning from capitalism to something better, but slipping into a system where tech companies function like modern feudal lords who keep us in servitude. Here's David's brief intro, and Cory Doctorow is the first to respond.
So to join us to talk about the book today, of course, Cory Doctorow, activist, journalist, best-selling author of this book, as well as The Bezel, Red Team Blues, and a host of others. And Yanis Varoufakis, economist, former finance minister of Greece, and also author of including Techno-Feudalism. Let's go back to 1986, the year in which Picks and Shovels is set. And Silicon Valley's got a capital boom. It's full of startups. We know what comes next. The tech oligarchy, the bullying of workers, the bullying of users, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Is this baked into history back in 1986, or was the chance that this could have been avoided?
Yeah, I've been giving this a lot of thought. I think one of the things this book is about is how contingent our history is, you know, sort of platform collapse and the decay of the internet into five giant websites with screenshots of text from the other four. We're not the outcome of like the great forces of history bearing down on this moment to create an inevitability, but rather like policy choices taken by named individuals, many of whom are still around, who were warned at the time that this would likely happen, who pressed ahead with it anyway, and have faced zero accountability for it. And so one of the things about this story is to show that like there were inflection points where people really were able to push back against attempts to use technology as systems of control, surveillance, commodification, and so on. And that the elimination or extinguishing of those moves, taking them out of the game, was a choice, right? It wasn't a thing that we did with technology. It was the thing we did with like WIPO treaties and Reaganomics. And, you know, given how recent this history is, I know 1986 is a million years in computer years, but it's an eye blink in, you know, modern human history. The idea that this is now fully cooked and we can't reverse these decisions, you know, the triumph of Thatcherism, right? There is no alternative, that it just had to be this way and we can never change it. I think we can absolutely change it. I think there are policy moves available to us that do have the chance of substantially unrigging aspects of our technology, which is good because one of the things we can do with communications technology is plan effective resistance and coordinate resilience in the face of calamities, both human centric and natural. And there's one bright spot about this moment. It's that with Trump dismantling free trade, the agreements that so many countries have entered into as a condition of getting access to American markets, which include these very bad tech policies, there's no longer any reason for them, right? If you're Canada and you made it the law that no one can refill printing cartridges or fix cars without permission from the manufacturer as a condition of getting access to the American market, and now Trump is charging 25% tariffs, you know, let's just get rid of that law. I think there are so many possibilities for other countries to incubate domestic tech sectors that specifically raid the highest margin lines of business of the most successful companies in America that have kept the S&P 500 afloat. And so that's like it's an effective trade response, but also like a very exciting idea.
That's going to anger President Musk quite a bit, I worry.
If like you could go to a mechanic and they could take all the subscription features in your Tesla and just turn them on permanently for one price, right? Imagine how much money he would lose in the stock sell-off after that started happening.
Well, congratulations, Corey.
Thank you.
Great, great book. Well, and it is a compelling story. It's a brilliant story. The moment when I felt the power of this wonderful and horrible capacity of these companies to effectively to capture you, to turn you into a serf, as I like to say. Yet again, the state, instead of using its power, its might, to break up monopolies, it is essential in creating the legal framework that reinforces monopolies. So, you know, this is a message to our former social democrat friends who keep having these weird dreams of regulation sorting out the problem, when it is in the end exactly the opposite process, the process of trust creation rather than trust busting by states that have been completely captured for decades. Let me take you somewhere else, because on the one hand, you've got this process by which you have the return of feudalism. This is fidelity computing. It tries to create a fief, call it a sect, to capture people, to capture both producers and consumers within one realm and extract the living daylights out of them in terms of rents. I remember back in 1986, 1987, 1988, taking us back to the time frame of your book, of your novel, I remember very interesting conversations between leftists and progressives and anarcho-syndicalists. And I remember there was that chap, you know, computer whiz kid, who was arguing that technology is going to effectively break up monopoly capital, because we would all be able to design everything using our personal computers. The economies of scale of a General Electric or a General Motors would simply go away, because we would have 3D printers, we would have all the hardware would become public utilities, simply because all the value would be created at the decentralized level of coders, of hackers who will then become important designers and so on. And it didn't turn out that way, did it?
Yeah, I mean, the empire struck back. I think that there are aspects of that prediction that are technically borne out, right? In the sense that you could have done that. I think that, you know, we saw, again, a great flowering of peer-to-peer technology in the Napster era, and not just file sharing, but distributed computation and so on. And instead of like continuing down that path, it reached this dead end with just blockchain crap and not a lot of like big distributed comp things. And distributed file systems, they sort of exist. IPFS is pretty good, but mostly what you have is big centralized clouds and giant data centers. I guess what I would say is that the forces that produced that were not technical efficiency or technical inadequacy, it was political economy. You know, I'm definitely of the generation that gets accused of being a techno-utopian or having been naive about technology in the 80s and 90s, maybe early 2000s. And I will put my hand up and say that there was something I missed, but it wasn't that technology could be used for terrible things. You know, I am a cyberpunk writer. Like, I knew that technology could be used for terrible things. It was that I thought that antitrust was still a going concern. Or even more so, I thought that because we'd had this rump of antitrust that was still around, these last gasps of it, that there was some intrinsic dynamism to the sector that would prevent durable monopolies from emerging, right? And you know, I came of age at this moment where the status quo was AT&T got broken up. I was 11 years old and I got a modem because AT&T had been broken up and their major project of preventing people from directly communicating with each other so that they could sell per minute, per feature calls was ended by, you know, Ronald Reagan. And then, you know, you had the IBM PC. And again, like, even though they got off the hook, they were not the IBM PC that had had its boot on the throat of the American tech sector for 60 years, right? They were a cowed and frightened and timid IBM compared to the company they had been before. And then when Microsoft rose up to take their place, again, like, the Clinton administration didn't manage to make it stick, but they whacked Microsoft around and personally humiliated Bill Gates. If you've never seen it, or if you haven't seen it in a while, I urge you to go and find the video of Bill Gates' deposition in the antitrust trial, where he's just freaking out. And like, you've never seen him like this. And he was personally humiliated. This was arguably, I think, the first viral video. People made VHS cassette copies and brought them over to each other's houses. And Microsoft didn't do to Google what they had done to Netscape, right? And so you got Google. And so from my worm's eye view, from 1982 to 1998, it seemed like, yeah, you got giants, but they were temporary and they fell over. And there was always fresh sunlight coming into the canopy, right? And I didn't realize that history was ending. I didn't realize that this was the end of it.
What do you think was the linchpin of this end of history, in inverted commas, of the fact that in the end, the one that got away, like Google, turned into a megalith that so far nobody has managed to unseat? Yeah.
Well, I don't know what the origins of oligarchy are. I think that Piketty's account is very credible, right? That if the rate of return on capital exceeds the rate of growth in the economy, that anyone who starts with a little money gets richer and richer relative to everyone else. And Piketty's got a very compelling example in Capital in the 21st Century about Bill Gates. So, you know, Bill Gates founded the most successful company at the time in human history. And over the period in which he was the CEO of that company, he made less money than Lillian Betancourt over the same period. She is the heiress of the L'Oreal fortune and has never done a day's work in her life. She just owned some money at the same time that Bill Gates was starting Microsoft. So she got richer than he did over that period. But then Bill Gates stopped being the CEO of Microsoft and became an investor. And in the years that followed, he made more money as an investor than he ever did as the CEO of Microsoft, right? So being a person with money was always going to be more profitable than being a person without. There comes a point where the distribution of wealth in the economy at the top decile reaches a tipping point. This is Piketty's thesis, and policy becomes beholden to the interests of that top decile. And it's a self-accelerating process where you get more and more capital-friendly policies, which creates more capital concentration, which affords more opportunities. And I think, you know, we can see that happening now in real time. You know, Keir Starmer just fired the top tech antitrust regulator in the United Kingdom and replaced him with the former head of Amazon UK. Yeah, I mean,
if I may add a couple of dimensions, sure, however, to that. The first one is that at some point, it wasn't just selling services, and it wasn't selling floppy disks with DOS or whatever, or word processing packages. At some point, this algorithmic capital manages to make us do a lot of work that helps it accumulate through our free labor. That's one dimension, which really turbocharges the rent extraction and therefore the inequality. And the second one is the 2008 financial collapse, because the process that led to the bailout of the financial sector was also the process that created a gigantic amount of liquidity, which went straight to the finances, went straight to big capital, to big business, and big business used it to buy back their own shares. So Bill Gates and anyone who owned shares was always going to find that, you know, in their sleep, their wealth accumulated at the speed of light, while at the same time, some of these folks, the big tech lords, I call them cloudalists, for a better term, they had free money to invest in their own algorithmic cloud capital, while we were working to replenish it. And that combination, to me, is far beyond anything that the little equation by Thomas Piketty can tell us.
So I think that there's a way to make these two theses compatible, which is that if you say, why is it, for example, that stock buybacks were reclassified not as illegal stock manipulation, but as a valid transaction, that is because you had enough concentrated capital to win that policy outcome. And then that produces the framework, the legal framework within which you see stock buybacks that then allow for a greater acceleration. And, you know, again, in like the last US election, where you have billions of dollars and $250 million from Musk alone being pumped into the election. And you can see that as like downstream of things like Citizens United, right? And that Citizens United itself was a very expensive project. And so, you know, Piketty's thesis is basically, if you go into World War One with almost all the capital held by the top decile, and then you destroy like 80% of the world's capital between World War One and World War II through this sort of orgy of war, per force, if you destroy most of the world's capital and most of the world's capital had been in the hands of the rich, then the rich are the ones who lose the most capital as a result. There's just not enough capital in the hands of poor people for their share of capital to add up to the amount of capital we destroyed in the wars. And that then you get the 30 glorious years during which policy, it's just, they don't have the surplus capital to pay for the policies. You know, David Sirota's series on The Lever about the Powell memo and how they spent their way into this moment, right? And how there was just like it cost a lot of money to produce the moment we're living in. And they didn't have the money after the war. They had the money decades later once, you know, and Piketty's view, once the capital flows show that the wealth accumulation in the top decile tips over. So it's not just the little equation R greater than G, it's that R greater than G means that unless you have some aggressive policy that reallocates or that redistributes, that over time capital will make capital friendly policies without opposition. And then you'll get downstream of that, these policies you're describing that are so friendly to cloudalism.
Yeah. Well, we are talking a lot about big tech, a lot about software, but the focus so far on the conversation, quite rightly so, is on Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. What about China? Because they have their own big tech. And even though a lot of their products looked very similar to what Silicon Valley has produced, and some of them are even better, as we found out recently, their political economy is quite distinct. How would you compare and contrast?
There are a few facts about Chinese tech that are not well known outside of China, though, that I think are important to understand. So when I was spending a lot more time in Brussels on GDPR and on other anti-big tech regulation fights, Nick Clegg was hanging around like a bad smell. He was the former deputy prime minister of the United Kingdom, who then went to work for Facebook for about $4 million a year to shill Facebook to his former colleagues in governments. And he would say the only thing keeping European cyberspace safe from Chinese communism is Facebook. Right? That was his pitch. And leaving aside the kind of yellow peril Sinophobia there, what he's saying is that the Chinese state views Chinese tech as a source of soft power that it projects around the world, in the way that obviously the United States did. And we can actually like describe the material mechanism by which they did it. It's not like the spreading of Facebook values. It's like the fact that the NSA was able to tap into all the data, right? That is a source of soft power for the United States relative to every country in the world, because they just had all the data looping through Silicon Valley and through US jurisdictions. China does not seem to think that. There's two reasons I think that we can understand that. One is that periodically Xi Jinping grabs some random Chinese tech oligarch and sticks him in a gulag, you know, like Jack Ma. He is clearly not viewing Jack Ma as being like an adjunct to the Chinese state, right? He's viewing him as a threat to Chinese state power. And the other is that the Chinese cyberspace directive, and we talked about this, Yannis, the Chinese cyberspace directive prohibits Chinese tech companies from blocking interoperability by competitors, right? They require new market entry as a condition, like the encouragement of new market entry as a condition of ongoing operation as a Chinese tech company. Now, I'm sure the realpolitik of this is that these companies wield enormous influence. They must. They have money, they have power, whatever. But the Chinese state has gone farther than anyone, even the EU with the Digital Markets Act, than, you know, the in the West has. And so, you know, the fact that the Chinese state views tech companies with suspicion and deliberately seeks to weaken their power is very interesting. And probably tells you that they're smarter than American leaders who actually are at risk of having their power usurped by their tech companies.
Indeed. I was astounded. It was you who pointed out that interoperability is a condition for entering in the market in China as a startup. And I found that astonishing and very encouraging. But there's also something else. It's not that Jack Ma was an enemy of the state. The way I understand it, and as a result of discussions with people in the know in China, they have a very simple idea there that exorbitant power comes out of these businesses, of these big tech companies, these cloudalists, and society has, through the Communist Party or whatever mechanism it devises, to put an effectively a ceiling to the extent to which the extract rents from the rest of the economy. And the problem with Jack Ma was that he exceeded that ceiling, and they just, you know, slapped him on the head and said, you go down there, mate. You're not going to make more than 20% returns on your capital. And if you do, you're out. And they didn't send him to the Gulag, actually. They sent him to Tokyo. And then now he's back, and he's, he has to work within the ceiling. But the other thing which I find interesting, and I just mentioned very briefly, because AI now is everywhere, it's all over the place, is the way in which the authorities in China are directing AI companies not to be ChatGPT kind of producers. In other words, to concentrate AI on improving the productivity of machinery rather than to create services for people to subscribe to and to become attached to as consumers of the results that they get from prompting the AI apps. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to mention that. I think David wants to butt in and to push us in another direction.
Sure. That's right. Yeah. Although I was just thinking, if I have to subscribe to one more thing, I'm quite simply going to die. We've at some point we've become saturated with subscriptions, right? I mean, we can do a whole episode, a whole podcast on that someday, and we should.
I just heard a podcast ad for a service that will figure out which things you're subscribed to that will unsubscribe you from it, and it's a subscription service. So you can subscribe to a subscription that will get rid of your other subscriptions.
Yeah, it's like, well, we released the cats to get the mice, but then we had a cat problem. So let's grab some questions from the chat now. This one I find really fascinating, and I think about this a lot. What can the average person do to combat outside of shop bans? How can we gum up the works?
Well, I think that there are four forces that constrain the conduct of firms. Right. So they're constrained by governments, by regulation. It's not a thing we're getting a lot of in the coming years, although it won't be zero. Trump is going to do what I call boss antitrust, which is where you target companies that are, in fact, violating antitrust law. But you don't target them because they're the worst offenders. You target them because you don't like them. and this is sort of, Xi Jinping did this, right? He had a corruption purge that ran for about 5 years. And there's some pretty clever mathematical analysis of the officials who were purged. You can kind of tell how corrupt they were by like how their regions were performing relative to similarly situated regions and how much money they were making and how much they were dispersing. And he really did just purge corrupt people, but he only purged corrupt people who were in the power base of his rivals and not in his own power base. And so you can be anti-corruption in a corrupt way. And I think we'll see some regulation. Markets do check the power of companies imperfectly, but they do, right? When companies fear losing your business, they do treat you better. That's why companies that don't fear losing your business don't treat you worse. That's why the water on the other side of the airport checkpoint is $8 a bottle instead of $3, because they know you're not going anywhere else, right? You're stuck there. And the third one is interoperability, right? That force I was talking about that allows people to break free. And I think, as I said, we have this opportunity for interoperability right now because the primary impediments to it are legal, and the primary vehicle for those legal impediments is U.S. trade policy, which is now being rewritten. And there's just so much scope for pushing for that. And then the fourth one is labor. And tech workers, although they are not unionized in any large number, have had historically a lot of power because there just weren't enough of them. And a lot of them really cared about their users, and they just wouldn't undo the good work that they'd done to harm their users, not least because they were driven like government mules by their bosses and worked 80-hour weeks and missed their mother's funerals and stuff. And they just were like, no, I'm not going to shitify this product. Now, of course, that's gone out the window. 260,000 tech layoffs in 2023, 150,000 in 2024. Facebook just announced across the board 5% layoff. For this year, there's been tens of thousands already this year. We're just at the middle of February. So that labor power is not there anymore, which militates for organized labor. And of course, Trump has just dismantled the National Labor Review Board, which is quite disheartening. And Trump thinks that by firing the referee, he canceled the game. He just threw out the rules. Like, there are lots of things the National Labor Relations Act gave to organized labor. There's lots it took away, like sympathy strikes, general strikes, sectoral bargaining. I would get involved in labor organizing if you're a tech worker. And remember, Sean Fain has called for a general strike in 2028. And so that is the next election year. And that should be the focus of our labor organizing.
Speaking of individual action, someone asks, why don't we see international hackers who aren't bound by DRM rules investing time into breaking things anymore?
You know, you do get people who do this. Last year, a group called Dragon Team in Poland was asked by a train operator to figure out why the Nuvag trains that they had bought kept bricking themselves. And it turned out that Nuvag had booby-trapped the trains so that if you took them to an independent service yard, the train would brick itself. And then they charged you 20,000 euros to remote into the train and restart it. They uncovered a mode to restart it where you went into the bathroom in like the third carriage, locked the door, pressed the guard call, turned on the tap, flushed the toilet, unlocked the door. And like, it's up, down, left, right, start, right? And then the train would start again. And they published on this, and they went to Chaos Communications Congress in Germany and presented their work. They're being sued under Poland's anti-circumvention law. That's why this moment, right, this trade moment is such a big deal, because, you know, somewhere out there is a Polish hacker yearning to breathe free. And we just need to get rid of Article 6 of the Copyright Directive. And we can be reverse engineering all the trains we want.
That was Cory Doctorow. He's a Canadian-British blogger, journalist, science fiction author, and activist. Doctorow had just announced that his most recent book, Picks and Shovels, was going into distribution. Picks and Shovels is the origin story of the most powerful new tool for crime ever invented, the personal computer. Doctorow was in conversation with Yanis Varoufakis, economist, former finance minister of Greece, and author of Techno-Feudalism, What Killed Capitalism. Please go to YouTube and search for the one-hour version of this rebellious and intriguing conversation. It's on the Jacobin channel under the title Picks and Shovels by Cory Doctorow. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.